afternoon. You are tuned to Arjuna Afternoon here on Tuesday, the 17th of February, the year 2015. Jeff Brown filling in for Scott Burton. Today, we'll get the details about this Saturday's History Research for Dummies presentation at the Juneau Douglas City Museum this Saturday. We'll learn about the Juneau Dance Theater's fundraising dance party also on Saturday. We'll find out about the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. We'll talk with Cynthia McPheeters about the Juneau Community Charter School's winter camp. And we'll profile Amarna Sangini about her Community Service Award. That Writer's Almanac, Burn on Music and More today on the Juneau Afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, partly cloudy skies with patchy fog, low temperatures around 37 degrees. Wednesday, cloudy skies with a chance of rain. Wednesday night, rain and snow, likely.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Members of the Menominee Nation hope to complete a 150-mile march by Wednesday. It's aimed at getting Wisconsin's governor to change his mind and approve an off-reservation casino between Milwaukee and Chicago. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio caught up with the marchers as they battled cold temperatures but kept their resolve.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has already said no to the Menominee's plan to team with the Florida Seminole tribe and open a casino and Hard Rock Entertainment Complex in Kenosha. Walker has repeatedly said he's worried about lower revenue payments from other tribal gaming halls in southern Wisconsin. But technically, Walker has until Thursday to change his mind about the Menominee project. As about 30 Menominee tribal members marched along a state highway between their reservation and the state capital of Madison this week, marchers hoped their effort would lead to a meeting with Walker. Menominee art teacher Janice Rabideau says she'd like the governor to know that the tribe might use some of the casino profits to help youth.
There's a chance that we could build a new school for these children. They're going to school in a very rundown building.
Others say the casino profits would also help tribal elders and military veterans. Over the weekend, marchers walked through sub-zero wind chills. Basil Richmond says he kept going because it's the same route his grandparents took in 1971 when the Menominee marched to encourage Wisconsin's then-governor to back the tribe's effort to get official status restored. Richmond says he's partly honoring his elders.
So, you know, what starts out to be one thing during this walk or journey, as in the journeys of life, there will be many other things that are more important than Scott Walker.
The Menominee's march will end with a rally at the Wisconsin State Capitol. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Lower Brule Sioux leaders met in tribal court last week in South Dakota in what has become a continuing battle for political control of the tribe. As Jim Kent reports, this phase involved two council representatives and the vice chairman. All three were newly elected to their positions last fall.
Allegations of corruption and mismanagement of funds during his 30 years in office led Lower Brule Sioux Tribal Chairman Mike Jandrew to walk out of a November Tribal Council meeting along with two council members who support him. Vice Chairman Kevin Wright and the new council reps voted to replace Jandrew and his two supporters. Jandrew countered with subpoenas for his three opponents, calling for a restraining order against any public criticism of the tribal government. That brings us to today's court hearing. But the tribal judge has a flat tire and arrives late. Then the tribal members and press are told to leave the courtroom without explanation. After 4 hours, tribal members and press are permitted back into the courtroom, having been advised that both sides had been negotiating. The brief hearing by B.J. Jones, a retired judge from the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation, results in Jones dismissing the subpoenas as well as the defendant's removal of Jandrew and the two council reps. He noted that both issues were tribal constitution concerns and beyond the purview of the court. Judge Jones then ordered a tribal council meeting to be held in March, during which both sides have been instructed to resolve their differences. Failure to do so could end in contempt of court charges. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States. with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support National Native News. Just use Pick, Click, Give, and select KNBA-FM Kewaunik Broadcast Corporation. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Supported by the Tribal Telecom and Technology Conference, Weaving Pathways Across the Digital Divide. The annual Tribal Telecom Golf Classic will be held May 4th, 2015 at the Isleta Eagle Golf Course. Info at tribaltelecomconference.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTMO News in Juneau and also KRNN FM in Juneau. First guest in the studio is Marcia Hamburger from the Juneau Douglas City Museum, here to talk about history research for dummies. And I don't take that personally.
No, hopefully people get the joke from all those other whatever's for dummies.
I've got a couple of those kind of books myself.
You do? Yeah, yeah.
So this is a panel discussion you're having this Saturday.
Yeah, well, if people don't know who Sandy Harbinuck, Mark Whitman, and Jim Garrity are, then you definitely got to come. And then if you do know them, you're going to want to come, because they are just some of our gold nuggets of our community in terms of finding and keeping track of Juneau history. And they're just fascinating people. So they're going to be on a panel talking about kind of the story behind the story, you know, how they find out what they know and how they go about researching.
Why are you offering it?
A couple reasons. One is I've turned to all three of those people, and I know a lot of people associated with the museum turn to them frequently with these kinds of questions. And they, as I said, they're just fascinating, engaging people. And also, the museum sponsors these Juneau History Grant Project. We have some funding that we hold and make available to the public if they want to apply, if they have a piece of research or a piece of history they want to do something about. And one of the issues sometimes that come up is people don't really know exactly how to go about finding out what they want to know, how to do research. And so these guys know how to do it. And so it's kind of a service or almost a workshop kind of a format for people who might be having a project, or if they're a student at the high school or university, something like that, just to sort of say, how do you go about getting started to answer a question about my house or my ancestor or a piece of history that interests me?
One of the phrases that you heard being bandied about are eureka moments.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had a meeting with the three of them last week where we were planning the program, and they have plenty of stories to tell. But it's interesting that some of the eureka moments, which they're going to talk about during the program on Saturday, is how long it takes sometimes. I mean, sometimes they're on the trail of something for years and years and years, and all of a sudden something will pop up and everything will fall into place, or they'll make a connection from one to the other, and then it's the eureka, and they had some funny stories to tell about, which they'll definitely share on Saturday.
What are some details that a lot of people overlooked because they haven't read the Dummies book?
Well, one of the things that they were pointing out to me that I thought was important for folks to know was, don't necessarily stick with the story you want to find. Stick with the story that you actually do find. They were talking about sometimes when somebody has an idea that a thing might have been this way in history, or they want to find this particular thing, and when they get on the trail of looking for that, it actually turns out to maybe be slightly different than they expected, or they unearth a whole nother aspect of the story that they didn't expect to find. And they say that it's most fruitful when you follow that trail instead of saying, nope, I'm not going to pay attention to that because it doesn't fit my preconceived notion. And I thought that was a really good piece of advice.
History grant applications are due. That's another reason to go to this workshop.
Right, right. Well, every year, once a year, people can submit applications and for some money that might fund their project. Those are going to be due around the end of June, and so there's still plenty of time. But if people are thinking about, oh, I have this interesting idea, and maybe I could use a little funding to help with publishing a book or doing some research or some travel associated research or whatever, you know, they can learn a little bit more about that on Saturday. And I probably should say the time. This is part of our Coffee and Collections series that we do about once a month on a Saturday. So 10:30 this Saturday, the 21st, 10:30 to noon. Heritage Coffee is our sponsor. So we'll have hot coffee, hot tea, and we'll have Mark and Sandy and Jim there so we can really pick their brains and hear their stories.
12 by 12 show coming.
12 by 12 is coming up also. And the submission dates for that, let me get that out there for people who know and are ready, February 24th through 28th, which is next week, right? So 12 by 12, if people don't know, it's our 11th year of having an all-comers exhibit. Anybody in town who wants to submit, as long as their piece of work is no bigger than 12 inches in any direction, and that includes the framing. And our theme this year is H2O color, or watercolor, so however that inspires folks. And so submissions can be dropped off at the museum the 24th to the 28th. There's a $12.12 fee for participation, and there is a submission form that's available on our website or at the museum when you come.
And talk a little bit about City Museum and Facebook.
I did. I know. I realize I haven't talked about Facebook, but we have a friends group, Friends of the Juno Douglas City Museum, and they do a number of nice things for us. One of them is that they maintain a Facebook presence. And a couple of things that have been going on. One has been going on for a while, which is Throwback Thursday, and that's a real fun thing to do. And many people do this throwback kind of idea on Thursdays, but, of course, we post pictures from our archives and from our collection and a little bit of information so you get a snippet of history. And then a new thing that Jody DeBryan, our curator of collection, is doing in conjunction with a collection we recently inherited of the photographs of Joseph Alexander, who was a commercial photographer here in Juneau between 1950s to 1980s, took all the graduation photos, wedding photos, you know, all that kind of commercial stuff, and we have thousands and thousands of his photographs, and many of them are unidentified. So on Wednesday, she's doing a who's who kind of thing, posting one of those images that we don't know who the person is, and it would be great if the community wants to go there on Facebook, and if you know who it is, get in touch with us so that we can attach the identification to the image. This is all kind of leading up to an exhibit that she's planned, and it will be executing for our summer show, which will open actually kind of I guess our official opening will be the beginning of May, and it's going to feature local some of the local photographers throughout history, including Joseph Alexander. And one section of the exhibit will have a whole wall full of unidentified photos that we hope people will drop in. And some of them even you will know who they are, but it's things like graduation photos of Bruce Botello and things like that. So it's really, really fun to look at.
Archie Hamburger, thank you for coming down and talking about the History Research for Dummies panel discussion going on this Saturday. Starts at 10:30.
Starts at 10:30, and it should be totally fascinating. Whether you want to do a history grant or not, it'll just be really fascinating and to hear these guys talk. It's like a history sporting event between those guys.
Archie Hamburger, thank you a lot for coming out.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 17th of February, 2015. It's the birthday of Ruth Rundle, born in South Woodford, England, in 1930. Her parents were teachers. She didn't want to be a teacher herself. She went to work for the local paper. She was not such a good journalist. One time she wrote a story about the local tennis club's annual banquet, but she hadn't actually gone to the dinner. So she didn't realize that the speaker had died in the middle of his speech. She handed in her resignation the next day before they could fire her. For the next 10 years, she stayed at home, raising a boy and writing in secret, trying out various genres, and then she hit on crime novels. She's written about 60 of them, most of them under her own name, including A Judgment in Stone, A Fatal Inversion, and most recently, The Girl Next Door. Ruth Rendell, who said, "Some say life is the thing, but I prefer reading." It's the birthday of the man who gave us the stethoscope, physician René Laennec, born in Quimper, Brittany, in 1781. 1897, on this day, the National Congress of Mothers held its first convention in Washington, D.C. It was the forerunner of the National Parent-Teacher Association. It's the birthday of the economist Thomas Robert Malthus, born in Surrey, England, 1766, published a paper on the principle of population in which he argued that the human population was growing at a faster rate than the food supply, and that war and disease and famine were necessary in order to prevent overpopulation. And it's the birthday of the novelist Chaim Potok, born in New York City, 1929. Grew up in an Orthodox Jewish home and wrote about it in his best-selling novel, The Chosen, came out in 1967. Here's a poem for today by Margaret Atwood, entitled February. Winter, time to eat fat and watch hockey. In the pewter mornings, the cat, a black fur sausage with yellow Houdini eyes, jumps up on the bed and tries to get onto my head. It's his way of telling whether or not I'm dead. If I'm not, he wants to be scratched. If I am, he'll think of something. He settles on my chest, breathing his breath of burped-up meat and musty sofas, purring like a washboard. Some other tomcat, not yet a capon, has been spraying our front door, declaring war. It's all about sex and territory, which are what will finish us off in the long run. Some cat owners around here should snip a few testicles. If we wise hominids were sensible, we'd do that too, or eat our young like sharks. But it's love that does us in over and over again. He shoots, he scores, and famine crouches in the bedsheets, ambushing the pulsing eiderdown, and the wind chill factor hits 30 below, and the pollution pours out of our chimneys to keep us warm. February. Month of despair, with a skewered heart in the center. I think dire thoughts and lust for French fries with a splash of vinegar. Cat, enough of your greedy whining and your small pink bumhole off my face. You're the life principle, more or less, so get going on a little optimism around here. Get rid of death. Celebrate increase. Make it be spring. February, a poem by Margaret Atwood from Morning in the Burned House, published by Houghton Mifflin, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 18 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests, Charlotte Truitt, Tom Lehrer, and Chris Benson, are here to talk about Juneau Dance Theater and the fundraising dance party on the 21st, this Saturday. Thank you for coming by the station.
Oh, thanks for having us.
So, if you were to answer the question, who am I for Juneau Dance Theater, how would you answer it?
For me, I'm Charlotte Truitt. I do the administrative work at the office for Juneau Dance Theater, and work to promote and encourage the love of dance in the community and support our families as their children are dancing, and then encourage our whole community to get involved in dance.
And I'm Chris Benson, and I'm on the board of directors of Juneau Dance Theater, and wanted to encourage people to come to our event this Saturday.
Let's talk a little bit about the Juneau Dance Theater for people who haven't heard about it before. 40 years ago, I guess it started as the Juneau Dance Unlimited.
Right. Juneau Dance Unlimited, and it started with a group of folks here in town who wanted to see dance thrive, but they didn't have an ongoing dance studio or a school, and it started with a lot of workshops and that sort of thing, and it's evolved. Rather than just bringing in guest artists, we now have a year-round school and over 200 students, and a lot of people know us as the folks who put together the Nutcracker Ballet. And some people may not realize we also do the Juneau Fine Arts Camp. So we're involved in other facets of the community. And this weekend's a time to get together to celebrate, have fun, and enjoy dance. And a wonderful style of dance that a lot of people like to do is swing dance in the 40s. So we thought it'd be fun to celebrate our 40th with the 40s music, and that would incorporate the Thunder Mountain Big Band. And we're always looking for ways to join in with other arts groups in the community. And so we thought that would be a really fun way to party and celebrate and enjoy dancing and give everybody a chance to dance. We'll have some dance lessons with Pat Bellick and help everybody learn how to do the foxtrot and get their feet under them. I know I will need some help. Me and my husband will need a few lessons for sure. And so give everybody a chance to dance. People come and enjoy our dancers, but now this is their chance to dance.
Tom Meyer, what kind of dances do you have planned?
Hi, and thanks for having me here on behalf of the Thunder Mountain Big Band, Jeff. There'll be music for any style of dance, including the foxtrot. Great big band music for people who like to foxtrot. You can rumba, you can salsa, you can tango, you could dance a samba if you can
samba.
Dance a samba.
Maybe even a polka. No.
So there's plenty of Latin music coming from the big band, yeah. And of course lots of traditional big band music. So I think some of those dances are the Lindy Hop, the Charleston, mm-hmm. the Shag, the Balboa. And then we also have a couple polkas. And plenty of waltz music, big band waltz music, and there's a couple of actual kind of soft rock songs I think the band is going to play too. And if I could just mention too, the band is sponsored and supported by Ron and Kathy Maz, and I think it's important for them to recognize the 40th anniversary of Juno Dance Theater, and they're making the band available for this dance on Saturday. So we're going to be ready for a lot of dancers. We hope there's a full dance floor because this is a dance band.
So a lot of ways that Juno Dance Theater has changed, including the name. What's changed and what hasn't changed at all?
Well, one of the things that have changed is we've grown. We've gotten bigger. We're providing more styles of dance training and on an ongoing basis for a consistency of training, particularly in ballet, which takes many, many hours of training and development, and we've had a lot of our dancers that continue in their training and move on from Juno. So we have a very high level of professional training that's going on now that hasn't always been the case on an ongoing basis, and a lot of growth. We now have about 200 students year-round in the program, and I think it started with pretty humble beginnings, probably down at the Sky Shrite Temple, and has impacted the community for a very long time. But what hasn't changed is the people who love dance, and there's been always a group of people that want to see it continue and thrive, and a lot of children that get involved, and families that appreciate the benefits that come with dance.
You want to talk a little bit about collaboration?
Yes, we are really working as an organization to get involved with the other arts organizations in town, like Thunder Mountain Big Band. And then next week we'll be working with a Juno Opera to Go with Todd Hunt and his crew with the Cunning Little Vixen that will be happening at Thunder Mountain High School the last weekend in February and then that first weekend in March. And so we have about 8 dancers that are joining in with that opera, and I think that's going to be very entertaining.
Chris, you're on the board. Why do you volunteer your time to Juno Dance Theater? What makes it important to you?
What's important to me is that Juno Dance Theater continues to be here in Juno offering classes and that it thrives, it be a thriving organization. So I'm working just to maintain our offerings and increase them if we can.
What would you say is the most popular kind of dance that's taught there at the...
We are most known for our ballet dance, and we start at the very youngest ages. Our dancers begin, some of them age 3 and 4, and then they carry on through high school and adults. So we offer more ballet than anything else, but we also offer hip-hop and modern, and even a new offering that's happening this year is Zumba. We have about 18, almost 22 people who are in a Zumba class, and that incorporates Latin music again, which is so popular today, and exercise, movement, and dance. I was talking to some of the ladies. They say when you're doing it, you don't feel like you're exercising. You're just out there having a good time. So they turn the lights off, and they put the fancy colored lights on, and it's kind of like a club atmosphere in our studio out in the valley, and people are loving it. So we're trying to hear what people are interested in and incorporate that as well to build upon the foundation that we have in good classical ballet technique.
Talking to the members of Juno Dance Theater and the Thunder Mountain Big Band, Tom Meyer is here from the band, Charlotte Truitt and Chris Benson are here from the Juno Dance Theater.
Can I tell them how to get tickets?
Please do.
We want them to buy their tickets. You can go online to our website is junodance.org. There's a link to buy tickets now. You can also get tickets through the Juno Arts and Humanities Council website. That's jahc.org. And you can buy tickets at Hearthside Books as well, or just downtown at the Jack if you go into the Jack. We'll have tickets available at the door also. It's a pretty good price for a fundraiser. It's just $35 per person for the adults, and student prices are $15. That's for university students and then all the way down to the youngest one. So $15, we're going to have heavy hors d'oeuvres, so you get to eat really well. We've got a no-host bar, photo booth to take fun pictures with your friends, and a silent auction. And Chris has been working with some of our other volunteers as well and might be able to tell you about some of the enticing silent auction items.
Yeah, okay. One of the interesting things is we'll have a traditional recurve bow on auction, as well as some whale watching tours, Alaska brewing sweatshirts, massage therapy certificates, landfill certificate. And we're also going to sell some dance costumes, and they'll be really cheap. So it'd be fun to come look at those.
Yeah. Oh, and dessert. Of course, you can't have a dance party without a lot of dessert. So if you didn't get enough at Valentine's Day weekend, come and get a little more chocolate with your sweetheart and dance. Silent auction items of desserts will be available, too. So.
A lot of stuff going on. It all starts about 7 o'clock at the Jack.
Yeah, Jack opens at 7. Dance lessons are at 7:30. And the band will be playing from 8 until 11. So you can dance the night away downtown this weekend.
All right, is there anything you'd like to add? I forgot to ask.
If anybody has questions or need more information, they can go to our website, junodance.org, or give us a call. You'll find the number there on the website as well. But thanks so much for your time, Jeff.
And thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thunder Mountain Big Band, they're going to be playing to him the Saturday night at the Juno Dance Theater event. It's happening at the Jack. It starts about 7 o'clock. In the studio is Callie Connerton, student body president at the University of Alaska Southeast, here to talk about the Banff Mountain Film Festival.
Hi, thank you, Jeff. So my name is Callie, and I'm with the student government out at UAS, and we are here to bring Juno once again the Banff Mountain Film Festival. It's a world tour, and it starts tonight, and it also runs tomorrow, so don't worry. But we do have two different nights full of amazing, epic outdoor films, and we're really excited.
Want to go with some of the highlights, please?
Yeah, no. So one of the ones I'm really stoked about is we have a bunch of mountain ones. We have a snowboarder tonight. We have a snowboarder that also, you know, has Haida Elders, and she does the fine art of weaving. We have a surfing. We have a amputee skier, as well as tonight we have rowing, fly fishing. We have paddle boarding. It's really going to be an exciting adventure. We have climbing as well as a dog film that's 5 minutes long, but it touches my heart. But it's going to be a fun show tonight. So we have 9 films tonight.
And tomorrow night.
Woohoo. Tomorrow night we have a flying tour over Greece, which I'm really excited about. We have an 88-year-old skier, and he's skied over 2,500 days in the past 79 years. I wish I could ski that much. And we also have a slackliner. We have a river expedition. We have actually one about a former Buddhist monk and his transformation of the life of abandoned children. And we have mountain biking as well as skiing. So it's going to be a really fun event. Both nights are at Centennial Hall at 7 p.m.
How much does it cost to get in?
For students with a student ID from UAS, or if you are a high schooler, if you attend elementary school, if you are in the K-12 system in Juneau or a UAS student, it is $10 per night. Or if you want to do both nights, it's $15. It's a bargain. It's $5 less. For the general public, it is $15 a night or $25 for both nights, which is, again, $5 less. So it's a bargain if you buy both nights. Both nights are different films. They're both exciting. They were both handpicked by not only Juneau residents but also UAS students that we offered in January of viewing. So we're really excited. It is a fundraiser for the UAS student government that we've been putting on, I think, 15 years now approximately. And it's a great way to reach out to the community of Juneau, because Juneau is such an amazing outdoor place to live, and we have so many people that are outdoor enthusiasts, and even people who are not. Like, I'm super stoked. I can't slackline, but I'm super stoked to see this person slackline. And, you know, it's really exciting to see different mediums and different ways that you can be outdoors and have fun and really just experience it with the person. And it's not just about skiing, and it's not just snowboarding. It's also, you know, the stories that come with the films. And that's really special about the Banff Film Festival, is it's not just music and skiing. It's the story that comes with it, and the overvoice talking about their adventure, their, you know, success. So it's exciting, or their sport in general.
And what time does it start?
Starts at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30, and you can buy tickets at the door. Or if you're out and about today, we have tickets at Aurora Project, Hangar on the Wharf, Rookery Cafe, Nugget Alaska Outfitter, Hearthside Books, both locations, UAS student accounts if you're all the way out there. So we're really excited about this.
All right, thanks for coming by, Kelly.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. This is the voice of a bird held sacred in traditional Hawaiian culture. In honor of its remarkable voice, a group of warrior chiefs took on the bird's name, Alala, to perform chants. Known also by the name Hawaiian crow, Alala are really more reminiscent of ravens, and unlike our backyard crows, Alala are highly adapted to life in the tropical forest interior. Alala were once common on forested slopes on the Big Island, but the birds suffered from persecution by humans, degraded habitat, and disease. And by 2002, no Alala were left in the wild. Yet, hope remains. Captive breeding is underway in Hawaii, and 2011 was the best year ever for the program, with 19 new chicks. In 2012, 15 survived to independence, and the total population now stands at 113 birds. While a previous attempt to return Alala to the wild came up short, we await the day when conditions are right to bring the sacred raven back to its forest. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
It's 35 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau and KRNN FM in Juneau as well. Our next guest is Steve Reifenstuhl from the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Organization. He's here taking care of some business before their annual meeting in March. Steve, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you so much for having me. Looking forward to it.
So what is the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Organization?
Well, it's an enhancement organization, and there are five regional enhancement organizations in the state, one in Southern Southeast, my organization, and then Prince William Sound, Kodiak, and Cook Inlet. Then there's some other major aquaculture associations like the one right here in Juneau, DIPAC or Macaulay Hatchery. And what these programs do are produce salmon in a hatchery setting from the egg to the fry stage and then release them to the ocean. The fish then spend between 2 and 4 years in the ocean before they return as adults. And when they return as adults, then about 80 to 85% of them are caught by common property harvesters. So they could be sport fish, subsistence, commercial. Most of it is caught by commercial fisheries and spread among the gear groups, the trollers, seiners, and gillnetters here in Southeast. It's a little different in Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet, but that's kind of the overview, that it's primarily creating fisheries throughout the state for common property harvest.
And you're here on the radio to talk about the organization. Why should a typical Alaskan care what happens?
This is a huge economic engine for the state. So the salmon that are caught throughout the state, if you look at that, it is 100%, 25% of that is enhanced fish. So not just from Northern Southeast, but from Prince William Sound and the other areas I've mentioned. So the value of that is anywhere from $100 million to a couple hundred million dollars a year to the fishermen, and that means to all the coastal communities from Ketchikan to Kodiak to Cordova. And so it's a major economic driver in these coastal communities. And without the enhancement program, there'd be 25% less salmon harvested. And you can think of little places like Sitka and Wrangell, Petersburg. If they didn't have that economic input, that would be, you know, painful for those communities. So a place like Sitka, we focus down on what NSRA does. Our average annual contribution to fisheries is about $10 million per year. And we've had years as high as $20 million and some smaller years, particularly in the past. DIPAC, for example, right here in Juneau, I think last year their value was about $11 million. They had a very good year last year. They had about $11 million contribution to common property fisheries. Now, this doesn't speak anything about the fish that are caught in sport fisheries. We don't typically tend to turn that into dollars and cents, but the value to those fisheries is also very important, particularly around Sitka, where we have a number of sport fish lodges, and they will target the Arking salmon and Coho salmon, and the value to them is probably in the order of a couple million dollars.
What specifically do you mean by enhancement?
Enhancement is in Alaska, so this is very unique to Alaska. The system itself is unique, and I'll go into some aspects of that. But in terms of what enhancement is, it takes a local salmon stock, so close by within, you know, 10 to 20 miles from where the hatcheries, where they're going to incubate the eggs. Take a local stock because they're locally adapted. They're brought into the hatchery as adults. The roe and the milt are taken from the fish and then fertilized, and then the eggs are put into an artificial incubation, and then they're incubated through the winter, come out in the spring as fry, and then they're ponded into the ocean. They're fed for a short period of time and then released to the ocean. So They're considered wild fish because they come from wild stocks around the hatchery program, released to the ocean. Then they have to survive the gauntlet that all salmon have to survive out in the ocean before they return as adults. So on a typical release of chum salmon, about 95% of those or more, 97% of those are going to die out in the ocean, particularly as small fry after release and as smolt, and then farther out in the ocean as sub-adults. There's also predation as well. And this is not unlike wild salmon. They go through the same thing. You know, sustainability in wild system is a one-to-one replacement for the salmon. Generally, in Alaska, there's a lot higher. There could be, you know, 2 or 3 or 10 spawners for an adult. But anyway, the point is that you need to have that replacement in the wild system, the same thing with the hatchery system. You need a certain portion of those to come back to the facility to perpetuate the program. If I may talk about the uniqueness of the program, the entire program is paid for by commercial fishermen, even though the benefits accrue to anybody that wants to fish. Commercial fishermen do pay for the program. They tax themselves. That money goes through Department of Revenue and then is reappropriated each year to the Aquaculture Association so we can perpetuate the program. They elected to do this back in the late 1970s. Legislation was passed at the time. Governor Hammond was a strong proponent of this program. And then that allowed the program to develop. Fish and Game initially started this type of program in the early 70s, but once the program developed into full production in the mid-1980s, the state decided to get out of it, and they disbanded that portion of Fish and Game. Formerly, it was called the Fred Division. It had about a $14 million budget in the mid-1980s, but that was disbanded, and now only the private nonprofits run hatchery programs, except there's a couple exceptions that Sportfish runs at Crystal Lake in Petersburg, and then the large facility in Anchorage, and then one in Fairbanks. But those are different. Those are really trout programs, some salmon, but mostly trout programs.
I'm talking with Steve Reifenstuhl from the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. They're having their annual meeting in March 11th and 12th. Is that something you encourage the public to attend?
Oh, yes. We will have an advertisement in the newspaper as well as on K2 announcing that we'll have our annual meeting. It's going to be held at the DIPAC facility or the Macaulay Hatchery Visitor Center. It will be March 11th and 12th. It's our board of directors meeting. We only have two a year. We invite the public. We will be inviting the DIPAC board to attend if they would like to, and we also will be putting out an invitation to the legislature.
Okay, thank you for coming by. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, it's just a tremendous program, and everybody should know about it, particularly in times of declining budgets. These programs are going to be even more important to the coastal communities.
Steve, thank you very much for coming by.
Thanks so much for having me.
45 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau, KRNN FM in Juneau. In studio with me today, people from the Juneau Community Charter School here to talk about winter camp taking place February 19th and 20th out at the Methodist Camp. Thank you very much for coming by, everybody. Could you introduce yourselves, please?
Yes, hi, Jeff. Thanks for having us. My name is Cynthia McFeeters, and I'm the facilitating teacher at the charter school. And I brought along two sixth graders with me today and some parents.
Hi, my name is Bronwyn Byford.
And
I'm Carrie McVeigh.
Caroline Byford, Bronwyn's mother.
And Bill Byford, Bronwyn's dad, and also a member of the APC in the Juneau Community Charter School.
So if people aren't familiar with the charter school, could you please educate people?
Yeah, hi. We're an optional program. We are part of the Juneau School District, but it's a program that families can sign up for. We are actually coming up upon the time of year when families can choose to sign up for an optional program such as ours, the Juneau Community Charter School. And it's a school that really does a lot of focus on whole child education and involving families in many of the aspects of the school.
How many students are in this charter school?
We have about 95 students right now at the charter school, and it's K-8.
And I know parents are a big part of it.
Absolutely, yes. Caroline and Bill are here today, and they've been with the charter school for many years. They've got two children in the school.
Yes, one of them, Bronwyn here, and then Arwen is her younger sister, and she's currently in third grade.
Is it fun?
Yes.
I was asking the students.
Yeah.
What makes it fun?
Well, a lot of the activities we do, like winter camp, and some of the activities there are skiing, art, the people that come in, and the free time. But what makes it really fun for the middle schoolers is they get to cook breakfast for pretty much about 100 people, 95 to 100. And
what are you cooking?
This year we're going to be cooking pancakes and sausage.
And some of the other things we enjoy are the skits we do. Skits are after dinner. We go outside to outside, I think. And, you know, we're each given a bag of props in the middle of the day to make, and we have to make a story out of them by the end of the day. And another one is s'mores. And s'more times we get to sit around the campfire, sing, tell jokes, and eat lots of s'mores.
Tell me more about winter camp, please.
Well, some of the Juneau Community Charter School's principles involve striving to engage students in the world outside of school, outside of the classroom, and helping students to understand about their community and all it has to offer. Winter camp is one of the ways that we do that. We have some amazing guests coming out to winter camp this year to help us learn. Richard Carstensen and other wonderful people from Discovery Southeast will be there to teach us about the big trees out there and winter adaptations for animals. Ishmael Hope will be out at camp on Friday to do storytelling with us. We have several other guests coming out. Irene from the Raptor Center is bringing an owl, and Sea Dogs group is coming, and Marcus Skoe will be doing a demonstration of Native Olympics.
Sounds like you have a lot of activities going on.
Yes, we do. I'd like for Bill and Caroline to tell us a little bit about the parent involvement at winter camp.
Well, parent involvement is great. Winter camp is actually every other year, so this is Brahman's third year, and my youngest, Arwen, will be her second year. So parents are pretty vital to the winter camp succeeding. We do a lot of prep work, a lot of the food cooking and stuff is brought by parents' potluck on Thursday night, I believe. A lot of the campfire activities and stuff are run by parents, so it's a good way to get involved and just get to know the kids better. I think it really is wonderful to work with these kids. They're all incredible kids.
I know I went with charter school a number of years ago and we did a lot of skiing. Is there snow on the road?
Ah, that is the question. We are crossing our fingers. Several people went out this weekend, and they were able to ski at the campground. And we have a parent who's working closely with someone who's going to try to keep it groomed out there as long as it doesn't wash all away this week. And so, yes, we're hoping to ski. We are bringing our skis in anticipation of skiing.
And this is for grades 2 through 8?
Yes, 2 through 8. And actually, the kindergarten and first grade class comes out on Friday, so they won't spend the night, but they'll be out there with us on Friday to do some of the activities.
That's like a lot of fun.
Yes.
Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Just one more thing. I did mention registration coming up in April for optional schools, but also our school will be part of the First Friday event, the first Friday of April, and a lot of the artwork from our students in grades K through 8 will be displayed on the walls, and we also have music that will be played from, we have lots of musical groups. We have marimbas, we have rock bands, we have string bands that will be showcasing some of the music that our students participate in on a weekly basis, and so we invite people to come and see us on First Friday, April 3rd, 4:30 to 6.
I want to ask the students here what their favorite thing about going to the charter school is.
The music programs that we do and the centers on Fridays.
The exploratories, because they're really fun and you get to try out new things that aren't in your academic day yet there at charter.
All right. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
The Thunder Mountain Big Band. They'll be performing this Saturday at the Benefit Concert for June and Dance Theater. In the studio with us, Amara Sanguni. She's named one of Alaska's two top youth volunteers of 2015 by the Prudential Spirit of Community Awards. It's quite an award, and she's here in the studio with us to help us talk about it. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
And tell me a little bit about yourself. Why did you get the award?
Because I volunteer for Helping Hands, trying to raise money to help them give food to people in need.
It seems like that's not the only organization that you volunteer for.
Hmm? Oh, I'm in Girl Scouts, so that's how I got the award. I got the award through Girl Scouts.
What did you think when you first found out that you got the award?
I thought that
I was like in a dream. I wanted that award really bad, and I thought that it wasn't real.
Now, the award you got was one of the Prudential Spirit of Community Awards. It's a nationwide program honoring young people for outstanding acts of volunteerism, and you're nominated by the Girl Scouts of Alaska in Anchorage. Do you think this is going to change your life much?
Probably.
In what kind of ways?
I will probably be recognized a lot more, and people will probably appreciate my work more.
You not only volunteer for your school, but also a Halloween carnival, Gold Rush Days, 4th of July celebrations, Christmas celebrations, and annual dinners for the Girl Scouts. How do you keep so busy?
My mom makes time for me, and we're really flexible with our schedule, and we try just really hard to be flexible and do as much as we possibly can.
What kind of things do you do for Helping Hands?
I sit at Safeway trying to sell tickets to an annual auction and dinner every year, and I volunteer for the Halloween carnival every year, the Gold Rush Days, 4th of July celebrations, and whatever Helping Hands ask me to do.
Sounds like you're quite a committed young person.
Yeah.
So what happens now? You get to go to Washington, D.C.?
I don't know. I'm going to bring my mom, try to learn as much as I can, and enjoy the experience.
Is this a cash award as well?
Yeah.
Well, congratulations. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No.
Well, thank you for coming down, and again, congratulations to you and your family for getting the Prudential Spirit Community Award.
Thank you.
Forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with patchy fog, low temperatures around 37 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, cloudy skies with a chance of rain, high temperatures around 43 degrees. Wednesday night, rain and snow are expected with 1 to 3 inches of snow predicted, low temperatures around 35 degrees. Rain expected on Thursday with high temperatures around 41 degrees. Thank you for tuning in to June Afternoon today.